This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO has a number of special t-shirts we've created just for you during our month of special programming. Whether you are a metalhead, a punk rocker, a bluegrass fan, or a feminist, we have a t-shirt for you. Wear it proudly in support of KBOO Community Radio. Go to kboo.fm/t-shirts to see all the designs. All proceeds go to support the work of KBOO Community Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 p.m. Next up, it's Labor Radio with Lane Ponce.
Good day. This is KBOO's Labor Radio, half an hour. And I'm Lane Ponce, your host for the day. And we have two wonderful guests today. My co-host, Susan Stoner, author and all-around good technical person who knows how to set up these Zooms. So Susan, let me hear from you.
Well, I'm happy to be here. I'm excited to listen to what Ron has to say. I've been very impressed with him. And so let's get on with the show.
All right. Our guest, our other guest is Mr. Ron Verzu. How'd I do on your name, Ron?
You're getting close, Lane. Like
how
a few more,
do you
few more years and I think you'll have nailed it.
Is it Verzu?
The Z is pronounced J.
J? Verja?
J.
You like say it for me,
like
Ron.
Bijou. If you said the word bijou, you'd be saying Verzu.
Verzu. Okay. Verzu. Mr. Ron Verzu. All around.
I've had many different descriptions.
I'm sure that Z confuses everyone. Anyway, Ron is with us this evening because he is a member of the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association. He served as the Oregon Vice President and also organizer of many conferences that we've held. He also recently, not too long ago, got his PhD up in Vancouver. At which university, Ron?
Simon Fraser University.
Simon Fraser. And so he's all around, academic and worker bee, and we're happy to have you here. And you're going to be discussing a lot about how the schools could better present labor history. Is this right, Ron?
Certainly that, and just to sort of plant that idea that should happen here, that labor history should become part of our education system.
Okay, and you want to start out with telling us what is Working Oregon?
Yes, indeed, Lane. Working Oregon is as much as anything a labor of love. I'm Canadian, and when I came to Oregon 10 years ago, I came with a long history of being part of the labor movement in Canada. I was associated with the Canadian Union of Public Employees for 25 years, worked for them, and I was also a local president before that. So my interest in labor history had been pretty well fostered by a whole lifetime of being in unions or being around them or working for them or with them. And when I came here, I didn't really see much that would be a kind of introduction to labor history in Oregon. I knew there were things. I had good friends who were labor historians or just interested in labor. I had Susan Stoner's novel, so that always helped. And that's a great contribution, by the way, to our understanding of labor history here. But I didn't really know where to go if I was going to teach a course or, you know, if I wanted to talk to a group of people, where would the book be, right? Where would that be? So I wasn't going to write a book. I'm not seasoned enough in Oregon politics or a labor movement politics or history, but I wanted to sort of prompt the idea that we should look at our history here in Oregon as something that should appear in book form and several books if we can do it, and that should be an idea that's planted with the powers that be to maybe start working on getting labor history into the curriculum of our high schools, and hopefully more enthusiasm at the college and university level. Hence, Working Oregon, which was my kind of modest effort to say, let's look at the history as much as we can. Let's look at the chronological scope of where we've been as a labor movement, where we've been as working people, what happened in the very beginning with the first contact with First Nations people as workers, and carry it right on through to today, really. And in fact, the Working Oregon has over 300 entries, and they're divided up by century and decade, and then independent year. So for example, I don't have the exact reference, but Susan Stoner's first novel is recorded on the year that, I hope it's right too, Susan, the year that it appeared. So we're, you know, it's that kind of a fairly vast approach to what is a kind of a bullet form labor history of Oregon. And we want to get it into schools if we can, but we know it's not a curriculum sort of accepted book, but we want to get it into teachers' hands. We want to get it into labor union hands who have educators, and many, by the way, have got copies of the book now, the booklet. And hopefully they'll be able to find some sources of inspiration to get labor history lessons going on their own, just picking out various periods of time and saying, well, this is what this little chronology has. Now let's expand on that, because every one of those 300 entries has another whole expansive story to tell about workers in this state. And so that, I'm going on and on. That's basically what the approach was. And I'm sort of proceeding now to distribute as many copies as the PNLHA, the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, could afford to print. And that was a very gracious move that we said, let's get it out to our members, and let's get it out to as many unions as we can, and particularly unions who have education workers as their members.
Ron, if someone wanted to get a copy of your chronology, could they go to the website at Pacific Northwest Labor History Association?
Yes, pnlha.org, and they'll get it.
Okay. Susan, since you mentioned your novels, maybe we should drop you into the chronology, not only when you wrote them, which is about one every year for the last 9 years, right?
Well, a little longer than that, but...
Yeah, thanks. And you start your labor history novels in an era around what time?
It's in, I think the first one takes place in 1902, which was sort of the heart of the progressive era, where it really started to pick up steam. And by progressive, I mean people who dedicated a lot of their time to economic and social justice. And then it just picks up on different things that ordinary people did. And I think the point that should be underscored in what Ron's goal is to let people understand that the rights and privileges that they have now, and what used to be the largest middle class in the world, I don't know if it is anymore, all came from the labor of laborers, of people who were working and their struggles. And I think most people, for example, don't realize it took over 60 years to get the 8-hour day put into law. So, I mean, it's something that that kids need to learn. One thing I wanted to say, my last book, which is about the Native American experience in Oregon, it's called Unseen. I was, I guess, dismayed, but not surprised, to learn that Indians were considered the best hop pickers in the Pacific Northwest. Farmers wanted Indians to come and pick their hops over white people, but they paid Indians at least 10 cents or more less per hour than they paid the white people. I thought that was just a perfect example of how, you know, the exploitation of people of color has always been there, and it continues, I think. One thing I wanted to ask Ron is, Now that you've lived for 10 years in Oregon with your lovely wife, I was wondering if you could maybe articulate some of the benefits and privileges that labor people in unions in Canada have that we lack in Oregon.
Be happy to, sure. I mean, starting off, in fact, I just did this research. In Canada, about 28.8% of workers are unionized. In the U.S., it's, I think, 10.9. These are non-agricultural workers. So right off the bat, we've got a much broader labor movement that can be built around that many workers. And I think also, just historically, we had a political movement started here by the labor movement, of course, in the early part of the 20th century, late 19th, but it evolved into a political party called the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, which was supported by labor. And by the 1960s, this party had become a relevant third party that we really referred to as a workers' party, and many unions supported it financially and as much as you can with the votes of your membership. And that, I think, made a big difference, because what we saw was some advances on the political front that maybe haven't been as prominent here. I mean, we don't have right to work legislation in Canada today, for example. I mean, we have lots of employers who'd like to see that, but we don't have that because there's a commitment, I think. Again, it's hard to generalize, Susan, but there's a commitment on the part of Canadians to respect the labor movement, or at least respect the workers that are part of it. And sure, sometimes there are quibbles about various leaders and various actions that are taken by the labor movement. But by and large, they support the New Democratic Party. They support the idea of a strong labor voice in their legislatures and parliament. And I think that's made a big difference. The coming of Medicare in Canada, which, as you know, is a big deal in Canada, was a pressure of the labor movement, really, and among other social movements. But that's the kind of thing that can be accomplished if you have a relevant third party. And I, you know, this is going to sound odd, but I think having a relevant labor party that just fights in the opposition has been pretty valid for us. That when they become legislatures, when they actually gain power, they haven't always performed quite as well as we would have liked a New Democratic Party to perform when it comes to labor. So those are a couple of thoughts on that. I just think there's another mentality here that says unions are okay. And we know from this country, when you're part of a union, you do get more money and you do get more benefits and you do have more advantages. And that seems to me to be a no-brainer. But I guess it isn't always the case.
We are about halfway through right now, and you're listening to you're listening. No, please don't. We're listening to KBOO, and our guest today, my co-host, is Susan L. Stoner, who writes many novels, and Ron Verzu, as close as I can get, who is a historian and is talking today about the need to extend history into the schools and to young upcoming workers. Okay, Susan, did you have any other questions for Ron?
Well, when I was going through your book, I noticed that there was a, are you planning to do another edition? Because I have an edition to put in there.
Well, that interesting you asked. What we're working on now is an online edition where there can be contributions from other people, feedback, and a kind of a discussion around the various points that are brought out in Working Oregon. So that's in the works. We're just working with a website person now to try and get that online.
What I appreciate about your book is it made me think of the context and the evolution of labor and its various activities, and the incident I'm thinking of was something called the Fry Roofing Strike in 1969. And the only two things that I would say that I think were significant about it is, first of all, a very well-known detective agency planted a spy into the strikers. And as a consequence, he talked some of them into contemplating firebombing. And then, of course, they went to jail and he didn't. And so that was interesting. That was my first introduction to the fact that the labor movement can have spies, although that's kind of an ignorant thing, because now, since I've learned, a lot of people were spies in the labor movement historically. And the other thing that was interesting, and it was the first time that sort of the lefty politicals who were anti-war joined with the strikers in a strike line and emphasized the fact that this Fry Roofing Company was just polluting the heck out of Portland. And that was a big emphasis too. And I think that was probably the first incident that ever happened, although I'm willing to be corrected on that. But you sort of inspired that line of thinking, sort of.
And you're going to send me an email with this, right, to trigger my
yeah, memory. Sure.
You know, one of the things I wanted to mention was that this, I sort of was a babe in the woods in a way. I didn't realize that, for example, the longest strike in Oregon history was a newspaper strike in 1959. So I started researching that. I dug out a friend of mine gave me a master's thesis on it. And we held a little workshop at one of the PNLHA conferences and had a Pearson speak about it. It's just sort of one of those things that popped out at me because I've had a background in journalism to some extent as well. And I thought these kind of things are, you know, just sitting there. You don't really know much about them. We have this glorious resource called the Northwest Labor Press, which reminds us every once in a while of that kind of thing. And that's just a really unique part of Oregon and South Washington labor, by the way. We have an organ. We have something that talks about labor all the time. And that's worth subscribing to. And some of the things I put in Working Oregon came right directly from the guys who put that together. What I wanted, and you know, other things like Dr. Marie Equi, I had never heard of. And here's a woman who supported the cannery workers' strike back in the day, and who was designated to spread Joe Hill's ashes when he was at, when he was.
That was led by women in Portland.
Right on. And of course, there's so many study of all of this, both of you, that is such a shock to learn about it because you don't hear about it very much. And then you get into it, and that's part of the prompting of this little book as well. Here's all these great things that have happened, and some pretty awful things too, by the way. But, you know, there's still a lot to study there. Let me make a point, by the way, about who's receiving this and what kind of responses we're getting. I know you two have enjoyed it and have commented to me, but I got a letter just anonymously the other day from an IBEW apprentice. I presume a younger person, everybody's younger by my age now. But he just said, gee, I'm really just a lowly apprentice, electrical apprentice, but I want to get your book and because I want to find out how labor fights back. And I thought, wow, if that's the audience we can reach, then let's give every apprentice a copy of this book. And we, in fact, have gone back to the apprentice movement and got people to say, look, make a decision to send this to kid, you know, the apprentices. So that's a kind of an impact it could have if you have young people that are interested. You know, I'm actually, it's a bad time to release something like this, by the way, I should say. This is COVID time, as we all know. We're all hunkered down and trying to deal with a crisis. And so it's hard to distribute something like this at this point in time. So we're kind of hoping that when the fog lifts, we might have a bit more of an opportunity to get unions to share this with their members. But that's the kind of thing that's out there. Young people crave knowing a little bit more about what's going on. They want to know more about the working past of this state. And it's good for them to know that. So that's a part of the goal here.
It's always a surprise when you find out that your own history contains, you know, union history too. I know when I was in the phone company and very young and ignorant, and there was the first strike and I was in college and thought, well, I have to work. My dad called me up. He very seldom called me up in person, but he said, do not cross a picket line. You do not do that. I said, well, I thought you weren't that big deal on, because he'd always been kind of a self-employed person. And he said, oh, I was a carpenter for so many years, blah, blah, blah. So you really discover things when you start asking questions of the elders or people that you know that work in union jobs. It really helps. And then with this additional work that you've done, Ron, I think maybe we can, you know, enlighten people.
I sure hope so. I wanted to say that this idea of bringing labor history into schools is not unique. They've done this in Connecticut. It's on the school curriculum there. They've done this in Wisconsin. Maybe other states. I haven't heard from anybody else, but those two have accomplished this. Now, it's a lot of work. You've got to educate legislators. You've got to, get the thing moving, and that takes meetings, and it takes a lot of prompting and promoting. But I think with something like Working Oregon as a kind of calling card, this may be something that the AFL-CIO or some group of people can say, let's move this ahead and see if we can't get legislatures considering this idea that they should insert labor history into the curriculum of our schools, our high schools particularly. You know, I'm a bit shocked to tell you to know that labor history has kind of fallen by the wayside a bit. You're more likely to find a course on business history than you are to find a course on workers' history and working class history. And I know that from talking to academics and going to conferences and listening to academics who say, I can't work labor history into my curriculum unless I hide it in a business course. And I was just shocked to hear people saying that. And I said, well, that's not going to work. But, you know, that's the kind of society you live in where, you know, it seems like it's relegated to second or third or fourth place, and maybe not at all, because, you know, it's business history is what's important.
So are you giving free books to high schools?
Wherever we can find them, or two or three of us are scouting out the territory to try and find
them. This has given me the idea. I have extra copies of my books, and not all of them, but the earlier ones. And I'm thinking I could distribute those to the libraries at the high schools. I used to work in my high school's library. And then if I had copies of your books, I could include that. So maybe you and I can talk about doing that.
No, great idea. Let's talk on email about that, because I'd love to do that. I had hoped to reach out to school libraries. And again, with COVID, I wasn't sure who to reach. And I was finding it difficult to reach anybody, actually, by phone. And there weren't many.
Yeah, you can. But at least in Portland, I can just drive around and deliver. And I've done that, so.
I think that's fantastic. I think that there's an opening here if we want to take it. We have to kind of make the opening, but sort of initiatives like yours will help to do that, and I hope mine as well. What to say? As I say, it's kind of fallen by the wayside to some extent. We need to revive it. It needs to be talked about. We don't go very far if we don't know where we've been.
Right. And, you know, the Burgerville people have joined up, and those are young people that seem to adhere to the ideas of unionism. So there's potential amongst that population, because they are the ones that are working at minimum wages, unlivable wages.
Yes.
So that is an upcoming group of people that could really benefit by this.
Yeah. And of course, they're referenced in Working Oregon. And, you know, talk about bunch of firebrands. They're just great. They spoke at our conference, as you may recall, and they were the hit of the evening for me. They really fired it out, two or three of them there. So, yeah, that's another really good advantage. Again, it's kind of logistical. How do you get to people? I mean, Susan's idea is just a great one, because then you can move them out fairly quickly. But, you know, we're working on it. And hopefully somebody will come along, probably not me, who will say, hey, I want to turn this into more of an elaborate production where we talk seriously about not just a bullet point entry, but the history that flows behind it. In some cases, there have been those kinds of things. Like I think Dr. Marie Equia's history has been written. There are a number of them that are the flood in Portland years ago. I mean, there's a number of books that are written on lumber workers or, you know, cannery workers, but they're not compiled in a way that that kind of is a, this, I don't want a textbook necessarily, I want it to remain exciting, but that it's there for you to grab onto in a more elaborate way, you know, just expanding on what the Working Oregon did. By the way, I want to say one thing quickly about sources. We have a great resource in our Oregon Historical Society. You know, if you look at any one of the entries in the Working Oregon and then go to the Oregon Historical Society's websites, you're likely to find a longer story that that kind of gives you a bit more expansion on what that story, that 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 item is about. And in addition, just announced it, as you know, in the Oregon Labor History Quarterly, there are a multitude of oral histories about this state and its working people. So there, that resource, and they are at the Oregon Historical Society, they're housed there. So there, there are lots, there's lots of room for expansion. There's lots of room for historians and students of history to go after some of this. Novelists too would tap into that, I'm sure, as Susan has done so.
Yeah, Susan spends a lot of time there, right, Susan?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and just,
I love it.
Yeah, so that's we're really in a way really fortunate to have that kind of resource, along with Northwest Labor Labor Press, which I mentioned earlier. We do have resources. We can develop our labor history. I was going to call it an arsenal, but not an arsenal, but a body of knowledge that we can work on and promote.
Right. And of course, don't forget, KBOO has the labor radio show every Monday at 6 o'clock. That's my plug for the day. We have about, a little over a minute left. So, Ron, you want to tell us exactly how to get a hold of your chronology? And then, Susan, you can give us some final words and we'll tune out.
One of the easiest ways to go to PNLHA.org, and it'll look for Working Oregon, it'll come up, and it'll give you the information on how to get it. I mean, I'm happy to give my email address right now if that's helpful, but it's up to you.
Sure, go ahead.
It's rverzu.
Verzu?
It's rverzuh at Shaw, S as in Sam, H. AW.CA.
CA for Canada.
They're in Canada, and I'm happy to send you one.
Thank you. And Susan, what would you like to finalize our show with?
Well, I think this has been a good discussion, because I really do think that labor history needs to be the forefront, not so much because we want to, not make the mistakes of history, but more because we need to be inspired by the fact that our country was transformed, absolutely transformed, by progressives, and especially the labor movement. And so it's an inspiration, because none of these people are famous with books written about them, for the most part. Many people lived, died fighting for economic and social justice. And what Ron's doing is he's basically saying, here in Oregon, here's some fights that had an impact.
Okay, I think that wraps it up for us. And thank you for joining us at the Labor Radio Show. Tune in next Monday. This is Lane Ponce, your host, signing off. Thank you.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? Policeman said to me, son, they won't build no schools anymore. All they build will be prison, prison. They won't build no schools anymore. All they build will be prison, prison. They won't build no schools anymore. All they build will be prison, prison. Cause today,
hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli, Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We're here with Takuma Jackson with the Mary Kiona Foundation and other projects too. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Right on. Thanks so much for joining us. And I know we got a lot of things to talk about in a short period of time. Can you start off by telling us your general kind of experience getting involved with work helping people inside and doing it inside and outside?
My story may differ from others, but being this is a prison pipeline, I'm sure there's some familiarities there. Of course, I started this work upon my incarceration. When I was first in prison back in May of 2000,